Welcome to The Steer, the show where we talk to writers about music and musicians about books, hosted by Jeff Alessandrelli and Joshua James Amberson. Jeff.
Joshua.
Bill Cardi.
Yeah, he's a person. He's a human.
A poet.
He's a poet. And he was on the radio program / podcast that we host.
He's about to be on it.
Right. Well, however you. It depends how you navigate time.
That's true. Yeah.
My friend Justin is actually writing all these poems about time. It's interesting, and he does like research on it. It's that Faulkner thing. What did Faulkner say about the past? The past isn't even past.
Oh yeah.
I think he wrote that in a book or something.
I think so.
But Bill Cardi is a friend. He's someone who has been, I don't think we've ever actually done a reading together, but he's been in Seattle for a number of years, and he works for, or he's an editor at the magazine Poetry Northwest, and I've always really liked his poems, which involve, I'm really into history, and they're not necessarily historical, but they have a lot of anecdotes or sometimes epigraphs from people like Keats and Jared Manley Hopkins, mm-hmm. and some poets that sometimes, you know, it's 2020. I mean, they don't maybe get as much reference. I mean, people still read those poets, obviously, but he directly kind of uses them in his work. I think Huge Cloudy has a quote by Keats on the back. He's someone whose work I've always really liked, and it involves naturalism, but it also has kind of an urban side to it. It involves fatherhood, frankly, a decent amount too, and kind of family. And although I have a family, I'm not a father. I was going to say I don't have a father. I have a father. I love you, Dad. But so his book from Octopus Books, Huge Cloudy, came out last year. But he'd been working on it for a while. I'd been a finalist at a number of different places. So it was cool to kind of see it in the world. And Octopus is a press that I'm involved with and I love very dearly. So also for kind of like friends to put it out to a degree.
Great. Yeah. Yeah, I loved Huge Cloudy. And I thought I wasn't familiar with Bill Cardi until I read the book and then realized I'd read some in a local literary journal, Big Wednesday.
Oh, yeah,
really,
yeah.
Love. And
Big Wednesday rejected me.
Oh, they rejected me too, yeah, but I still really love them.
Yeah, no.
They get a lot of submissions.
It's a nice journal, Big mm-hmm. Wednesday.
It is.
Very What's handsome. Up, Bill? Why are you getting in this and Joshua and I aren't?
We'll have to ask him.
We'll have to ask Bill or Big Wednesday.
Yeah, maybe both.
Right. Bill Cardi, The Steer.
If I just be myself, I'm ahead of your tails. Red paint on my nails, keep shit to myself. Listen to myself, writing bars in my cell. Rice next to my kale, shirt holy like grail. Distant for my health, my name whack ring bells. Yes, I've changed like whales, I'm doing so well. So I say, oh well, I don't tell no tales. Should've spent time in Yale. Bitch, shut up, don't yell. Here, boy, take this L.
Bill.
Yes. Hello.
Welcome to The Steer.
Good to be here.
It is good to be here, isn't it?
Yeah.
Very exclusive. what does Tierra Whack mean to you, and how does she fit into your life?
Oh, good. Excellent question.
Tierra Whack, Black Nails. Is that with Black Nails?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, So the songs I sent you, some of them I was thinking of as fitting into my life, and then others I was thinking of as being more relevant to process and writing and stuff like that. And that particular album, Whack World, is 15 1-minute songs,
right?
And they just kind of, it's got great hooks, great melodies, and so it's catchy, but then it also, because the songs are only a minute long, I think they kind of leave you, you sometimes stop short at the end of it. You're like, you're following that melody, and then you're like, what, it's over? I'm not ready for that. So I was thinking of, I think that's kind of like an audacious, maybe anti-commercial, although I think she was also nominated for Grammys for that.
Really?
Yeah, like maybe for the video or something like that.
Oh yeah, that was pretty amazing.
But, so the format, like the 1-minute songs, 15 1-minute songs, really interested me. And also the idea that here's a project that's just going to take whatever shape it needs to take, and that's what you get, which I kind of think of as what a poem does. Like, it sets out, you're like, here's a poem, and a poem can be very long, it can be very short. I was also thinking about that Whack World in relationship to like the culture of zines, which is a similar thing where you have like a project that I went to visit the Zap Zine Archive at the Seattle Public Library, which used to be at the Hugo House and is now at the Public Library. And there's something about seeing all these, you know, what a zine is depends on the person making the zine, right? Some of them are big, some of them are small, some are 8 pages, some are 200 pages. So, just thinking of like a work of art taking its, you know, taking its own shape. That's what I was thinking of.
Just not imposing the form before.
Right. And not like, finding its own way to completion, I guess.
Right. And how did you discover, like, my friend Derek sent me, I think, that tier, like,
yeah.
And I listened to it last year in Ashland by myself. And I listened to it twice, because, I mean, you can listen to it a bunch if you want, because it could take, you can listen to it 4 times in an hour. And I liked it. It's very short.
It is very short, yeah.
Which is great. It's also something that I, like Earl Sweatshirt has his latest album, or I guess his two last albums are very short. The rapper Mike, who I really like a lot, has really short songs, and it seems to kind of fit in with things that you know, concept albums like Dark Side of the Moon, I mean, they have their place, but people don't seem to do them as much. I mean, or like a hip hop, like Life After Death by Biggie, who's like my favorite rapper. Like, it's, you know, who has the time for that? But then also when it's 15 minutes, it's interesting too. Like, it's hard to, for me sometimes, to totally grasp, you know, to totally like get in, you know? How did you discover her? Just,
I think it was a standard, like, saw the name enough online eventually.
Oh, really?
I think so. I don't, yeah, I was listening to it on my drive down here from Seattle today, and I was trying to remember that actually, and I was like, was it a podcast? I couldn't totally remember. Maybe a year end list. It's
right.
Kind of like December now, the year end list season. I feel like I do a lot of finding new music.
Then, I do too.
Yeah. It's like at that point where the names you've seen kind of repeating. I don't remember exactly where I first heard it.
I think there's some interesting questions of satisfaction in art with the Tierra Whack album, and just kind of what you're saying about the concept of a poem, you know, and your experience with it, Jeff, being like, all right, that was cool, but it was very short. Is that satisfying?
Well, and I think it goes to expectation.
Yeah.
I mean, sometimes with longer poems, we expect certain things that, you know, I mean, maybe we get or maybe we don't get, but whereas maybe you can get more in a shorter poem, but we don't expect it. I mean, I think that there's a lot in that Tierra Whack album, and I think, there's not as much fat, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. Whereas some longer albums where they have interludes and they have all that crap, which frankly, I don't always particularly like,
right.
But it feels part of the whole. I don't know. It just goes, I think, to listener or reader expectation, which can be challenging for the person creating it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it also appeals to what I find myself doing when I'm writing poems, which is often, you know, it's happened many times where I've written a poem, I'm reading it aloud, and then when I read it to people that I'm like, oh, it ends here. And like a couple times I've like actually stopped and been like, oh, no, that's the ending.
Right oh, really?
There. But the poem on the page went beyond that.
During a reading?
Yeah, during a reading.
Huh.
Or I've had like a friend say, you know, like, good poem, but it ended there. And I was like, I know. It should have stopped there. So yeah. I've had that experience too. So there's something about, and in terms of my process of writing and revising, and when I was putting together the book, I found that I'd worked on it for years, and I would often have to go back, search my submissions and archives and stuff like that for the earlier version before I, like, overcomplicated things, added too much, revised it too much.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, I think there's something about, like, that distinct, that abrupt, like, ending that you get. Yeah, when I was driving down here and listening to Tierwack, it was just, like, find myself humming in the space mm-hmm. between songs because you kind of follow those melodies beyond their end. And I think a poem can do that too, where it's like, yeah. you know, that the ending kind of rings after the end of the poem, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you want people, I don't mean you specifically, you want people to want more, not to be like, this is great, I'm glad it ended.
Yeah, yeah. That's why the 12-minute reading can be better than the 25-minute reading,
yes.
right? Yeah.
But you also, you have children.
I have two children, yeah.
Of younger age.
Yeah, 4 and almost 1.
So you have limited time. So it's easier for you to listen or to write something that's shorter in some sense than... Well, it's easy to listen to that Tierwack album if you have other things.
Yeah.
Because you still get an experience, quote unquote, but you're not there for an hour and a half.
Yeah. Yeah, it does... Has probably changed my music listening habits.
What about your writing, though?
Yeah, that's a total mess. That can be tough. Right now I'm teaching 2 days a week, so I have like a couple days that are without kids that I can try to, you know, exercise, write, do all that other life stuff, clean the house.
Because you teach during the days that you try and write when you're teaching?
No, I teach
2 days a week.
I teach at a community college and then at the Hugo House in Seattle. So I teach like mostly mornings, Monday, Wednesday. It depends. It changes quarter to quarter. But
right.
I lost my writing room when I had kids, which is great that they're worth it.
They're going to listen to this years
yeah,
later. And be
yeah.
Like.
Well, it would be one thing. It's just unfortunate that that's the bedroom. The kids' bedroom, and then they're always in our bed too. Mm-hmm. So they're not even using it. Don't appreciate it, but yeah, I have an office that I rent.
In
the neighborhood, so I kind of cool. It's like a.
So you have a place to go.
It's
to.
Basically like a you know remodeled storage facility with a wall or like a window that looks at another window, and I just kind of go in there, and I don't have internet in there, so I have like my old computer with a bunch of music on it and. Listen, put on music, and then try to write there. I don't get there as much as I should, but I have like piles of books there, and it's a good place to have like a, you know, quiet,
right,
quiet That's spot nice. Away. It's yeah. like surrounded by therapists and masseuses and stuff like that. So that's also handy. That's good for the poetry.
Yeah.
Did you anticipate that when you had children, that my whole life, and especially my writing life, which I'm sure you're invested in, is going to change, or was it not? I mean, did you take a walk around the block and think about everything?
I don't know. I didn't plan too much. I mean, I planned to have kids, but... But it wasn't like... I was like, it'll be good. We'll work it out. I'll find time for writing and...
Which you have, but you seem even keeled. Whereas I have no children, I have a dog, and I am not even keeled.
Yeah, well, there's something time.
I'm very fussy all the time.
Yeah, time is like I started this book when I had a
huge cloudy.
Yeah, started the bulk of this book when I had a fellowship in Provincetown for the winter. So that was like
so you had a while. Okay.
Yeah, so that was 7 months. October 1st, okay. May 1st. But that was theoretically the most time. There were no responsibilities there really. You had to give one reading. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you just had an apartment, had like a community of writers and artists, and I felt such a time crush there. Like, oh, I don't have time to do all the stuff I want to do. I'm never going to read enough or read enough. And so I felt that in that setting, and that kind of, you know, helped me realize that that's always going to be a thing, like wanting to do more. And I think that's okay to like want to have more time to write, but not like make it. I get a little grumpy if I don't write, so
really?
I have to like have that outlet. And my wife recognizes that too.
So you're kind of saying that in any given even a huge amount of time, you'll want
you'll want more time.
You'll feel like there's always more to do regardless of the situation. So
well, you read one book and then that book points you to five more books, and so like that that type of stuff builds on itself in a way. And plus there's all the time I waste, you know, on Twitter and watching sports and stuff like that. So, you know, there's, it's not a pure.
Well, that's not, Twitter I'd say is a waste, but sports isn't.
Fair.
It's interesting. So I have a letter hanging, or I taped up in my office. My office / library, that Dennis Johnson wrote to a to one of my friends, older friend. And he did that Provincetown, Dennis Johnson did, I don't know, I mean, 1992 maybe. It's been around a while, and it's a good one, right? I mean, you're there for 7 months, it's paid for, it's like a legit thing, right?
Yeah, you get like a, I think, it's like a small stipend. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not as much money as some of the other, like the Stegner Fellowship or Wisconsin. It's like $750 a month. So it's like a little bit of money, but it's also, I think that's part of it. You're kind of in this, like, no one's spending money. There's like, I remember coming back to Seattle, and like, I would go out to eat once a week there, basically after yoga class. We'd go, go to the bar and go out to eat. But like, typically, you know, like people were just at the center doing their, at the work center doing their thing in the lounge. There's a lounge area. There's like a common area with a ping pong table, that type of thing.
Right.
But, yeah, there's something about like not having ways to spend money that like coming back to Seattle and just like Seattle's always changing as Portland is, and it's like the amount of restaurants I remember. It's like, how many restaurants can there be in one city? Like, and
But he was just saying, and this wasn't to me, but that he did that Provincetown residency and he didn't get a lot done because he was thinking so much about all the time he had. And about, I don't know if he was focusing on what he wasn't getting done, but what he could get done and all the free time, I guess. And I've never done, I've only done one residency. I haven't really applied for too many. Was that, but was that instrumental for you? I mean, you got a lot done because you were like,
I got a lot done.
I think people do get a lot done. That's why they do them. I think they also do them to put it on their like CV, but, I don't know. It's interesting how different people kind of react to free time, because sometimes you can react to free time in ways that are not conducive to writing. Whereas if you don't have as much time and you know you have 14 minutes before your 1-year-old wakes up, I mean, you get down to it. So,
yeah, I think I do a lot of revision in that kind of in between time that I wouldn't have done. But when I did that residency, I had a reading in December. Like, there's a different, every month there's after November there's a reading and an art show. So I had the first reading and I was determined to read like all new stuff for 20 minutes. So I like I focused pretty hard for that first, for those first 2 months, on generating new work. And then I think I kind of wore myself out a little bit. Well, then it was the holidays. And then the second half of the year, or the residency, I mostly just read. I took a lot of notes, and I've still like am making poems out of a lot of those Word documents that are just like pages of stray observations and things like that. But I was able to do a lot of reading, and
which is a form of writing in its own way too.
Definitely,
if you're a writer, which I mean, this isn't original, but when you're writing, you're often reading, or when you're reading, you're often writing in some way in your head, or you're the way that's coalescing. I mean, yeah. It's not wasted time. Because sometimes I feel if I'm just sitting around reading, you know, I feel like, I don't know, that I'm not getting something done.
Yeah.
Especially if I'm reading like, even like a newspaper or something that isn't like a book of poems, you know?
Right.
Joshua, do you like to read?
I love to read. Yeah, I do.
Do you ever feel guilty about that?
I do. Yeah, yeah.
Do you really? So I'm
sometimes,
not the only
yeah,
one?
No, no. Yeah, I do. Where I'll just be like, oftentimes if I'm reading a lot, it's not a time where I'm writing a lot. So that'll happen. You gonna put on a song?
Yeah, let's actually listen to Gangstar X'd or X Girl to Next Girl.
Heartbreaker, love maker, backbreaker. But then I made a mistake. Yes, I fell in love with this ill chick. Sweating me for money, my name in the deals, Nick. My homeboys told me drop her, cause it would be to my benefit. She used to say I'd better quit hanging with those derelicts. Romancing is my thing, but I can swing with no scheming hoes. Wherever my beamer goes, you know that I'm driving. Surviving in the 90s is a must, so I trust that everyone listen up. As my vocals give thrust, I bust my rhymes first. Never chasing a skirt, do much work while other suckers need more time to rehearse. Now back to the ex-girls, ex-lovers, ex-friends. It made me mad to find that she was only after my ends. She phones me and goes on about her new life now. I wish she knew right now. I think she's busted, let's discuss it. When I was with her, no trust, just fights. Just the he say, she say, and the neighborhood highlights. Now I got my new girl, or as I say, my baby doll. But still I'm getting crazy calls, my ex-girls got balls. Don't wanna play the field, cause I get loving at home base. Don't give me no long face, just exit.
Gangstar.
Yeah, Gangstar was one of my first. I was thinking about this album as more biographical. I couldn't decide which album to use. This was from Daily Operation, and then what is the next one? Hard to Earn, I think, is their next album.
Yeah.
Those were two that I listened to a lot. I was born in 1981, so they came out when I was like in middle school, early high school. And
that was Daily Operation. Okay. So 92, Daily Operation, Hard to Earn, 94. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was thinking Hard to Earn is the one I heard first.
Right.
And I was just thinking about music and like my relationship to music. And I remember so like those early 90s rap albums were the first albums that I can remember every store almost where I bought those cassettes and CDs. You know, I bought Hard to Earn in Toronto.
Right.
I can like still picture that record store. So there's, and I grew up in a small town in Maine. So it was like, there wasn't really much in terms of a music buying opportunity nearby. So it was always like I was visiting my cousins in D.C. and bought Grave Diggers. I remember buying that album.
Yeah.
Or like
RZA.
Yeah, or going to the Main Mall and buying Ready to Die. Like all those albums, I have like very specific memories of, you know, I'd also hear about them before I was like going to buy them. So it was more of an event. Like I don't have that same experience where it was like it would either... I was also trying to think about like, well, so where did I hear about those things?
Right.
But I think it was, you know, a mixture of The Source and like MTV Raps. And then I had a friend in town whose dad lived in Philly, and his brother and he kind of moved back and forth from Philadelphia to Maine. So they knew much more about rap than I did. So that was kind of hear about these albums, and then it was always like, okay, we're going to the mall.
What town in Maine are you from?
I'm from a town called Thomaston. It's very small, like 2,500 people.
So it's real. So it's small.
Yeah.
What's the nearest bigger town?
Rockland and Camden are more touristy, artsy, but it's like it's called the Mid-Coast area. So it's on the Penobscot Bay, like pretty much on the diagonal of the coast, like right in the middle of the state, like an hour and a half north of Portland.
Okay. And then do you have siblings?
I have a younger brother. Yeah.
Okay. But so he wasn't necessarily getting you into things.
No.
Okay.
Yeah. So my parents are into music.
Okay.
My dad and his brother were big, I would say, record collectors particularly, but, I didn't really at that, you know, I wasn't listening to their music at that point. Although right. I did like later on get into Bob Dylan, Bruce Springsteen, mm-hmm. Graham Parsons, like all that, you know, that was all in my house. But yeah.
I guess I have several questions, but I'll start with this good. One. Yeah. What do they do? What are your parents? Were they writers? Or I mean, was literature or how did that?
They were English majors, so there were books in the house. Like, there were a lot of books, a lot of, you know, standard college curriculum. Lowell, Bishop, that type of stuff. Yeats, right. Auden. And my dad was a social worker.
Okay.
And my mom was a newspaper editor for the local paper when I was growing up, and then she started working for like a computer trade magazine editing. But one of my earliest, I remember she used to have like all those reporter notebooks, like a stash of reporter notebooks, and mm-hmm. I remember keeping one by my bed, and this was like in fifth grade. I would write down like there was like 92 Moose, of course, was the name of this radio station. They had the top 9 at 9.
Okay.
And I just like every night I'd like write down the top 9 at 9 in this reporter notebook, turn the page, you know, the next day, keep a record.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's really cute.
Yeah. It was Moose.
So Gangstar for me, like I learned all of my music through skate videos.
Right, right.
So like not exclusively, but like Moment of Truth, 98, like that's when I first heard like Guru and Gangstar.
It wasn't my introduction to Gangstar, but it's the one that got me into it. And then I worked my way back.
Right, right.
But
I think I did hear, I heard Mass Appeal. I grew up in rural Washington, so a lot of my music buying is like that too. I can remember every time I went to Seattle, I would be like, okay, what am I gonna get, you know, like I'd have like a wish list.
Take advantage of those opportunities.
Oh yeah, I can still remember where I bought certain things. I was on the East Coast visiting a cousin in I think 94, and I don't know that it was, other than MTV Raps, Gangstar wasn't really on main airplay on MTV. But on a like local station in New York, I think I heard Mass Appeal, and I was like, whoa, that's a cool song. But it wasn't until Moment of Truth that I really started listening.
Well, and DJ Premier was on a bunch of stuff. I mean, he was part of Gangstar, but he did beats for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Do you think it matters, though? Like anything in the world, but what do you think it matters that we remember, we're all in our 30s, we remember where we got these things. People nowadays, they find something on Spotify. I mean, I think the common thing is, oh, it was better when I made a special point to go. For me, it was like Warehouse Records, and I guess I do have that, and it seems kind of quote-unquote special to me, but do you think that really makes a difference or not?
I don't know. I was thinking about how I don't really investigate.
No.
I think with so much information, there's like less need to investigate. So like, I don't know a lot about a lot of the musicians who I listen to now, right? I'm not like, I need to know their biography in a way that I think I did
but
in
the
past. But
you're busier too.
I'm busier too.
You have a job. I mean, it'd be kind of weird if you were going down a rabbit hole. Like, I don't know. What?
I was just thinking that I do go down those rabbit holes, but it's because I don't have kids.
Well, I don't have, I mean, I guess I do too. I mean, but to your point, you said with more information, it's easier to investigate less.
Yeah, there's something about like, there's no pressure on that investigative impulse. Like, it's not like a challenge and there's also like so much, I think public facing story. I feel like the story, you know, you could go to somebody's, there's both a more direct perhaps connection to artists because you can go to their Instagram or Twitter and stuff like that, but that's also like a public facing thing that people are doing, so that there might be something, I don't know. Maybe it's a lack of time, maybe it's just like I just listen to music.
Yeah, I think there's something to be said, and maybe this is just nostalgia speaking, but that there's something to be said about having an occasion around the music that you know, enjoy, you know, the music you're passionate about. There's, I think it's harder to, not that we need physical media, but physical media did create an occasion in this way that was, that it's kind of interesting, right? You know, that we have stories around it that are bigger than, you know, at least slightly bigger than I heard it on Spotify.
No, and, I would agree. I mean, I think it's common to be like, it was better when you had to go to Sam Goody and buy that crappy plastic compact disc. Right. And I guess I agree with that. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm just wondering if that's because I'm old.
Right, because there is a kind of corporate aspect to that too, right? Where it's like we're being sold some crappy plastic.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm trying to have it both ways. I'm just curious. If,
right, yeah.
So you grew up, and then when did you start writing? I mean, in like high school? Like, what were you, how did it go down?
Yeah, I think mostly it started in high school. It started.
It felt. It's nothing to be proud of, though. It's started, more of a disease.
The habit.
Is this a recovery meeting?
Began, yeah. Yeah.
No names.
Definitely in high school, I would say. But I didn't really read too much poetry until college. And so, like, the early, I just did a poetry reading in Seattle for Lit Crawl, where it was every writer read stuff they wrote when they were 18,
and then
contemporary stuff, and man, it was tough to go back through like the high school. I actually had
I don't know if like I have a portfolio from when I'm 18
that my mom dug up.
Oh, okay.
And then
so,
like my earliest like save files of like college writing were when I was 18, and man, it was not like, oh, there's a spark of something there. It's just like very cliched. Yeah. I was writing, like basically trying to write Bob Dylan lyrics, you know, like that type of, I was numbering, I would find the poems and they would have like just random numbers assigned to them because that's what Bob Dylan did, Rainy Day 12 and 35, right? You know, just be like, poem 32, and then, you know, and then it would be about like the ocean and whatever.
I do have some poetry zines from when I was 18, and they're pretty rough.
Yeah. So I didn't really start reading poets who I don't know.
Bob Dylan, no offense, won the Nobel Prize for literature.
True, yeah.
So I don't. That's a whole different conversation. But he's arguably a poet too.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I took a seminar on him.
Oh really?
In college. Wow. Yeah. The lyrics of Bob Dylan. It was pretty. It was pretty great.
That sounds good.
Where'd you go to college?
I went to Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. Okay. So also rural, kind of isolated place in a lot of ways.
So you had to read when you were 18, stuff from 18, and then now.
Yeah.
That's a very deceitful conceit.
Yeah. It was, we came up with it.
You were one of the ones?
Yeah.
I don't know if I would frankly feel comfortable reading something. It'd be so embarrassing.
It was pretty embarrassing. But it also, took an edge off, I would say. So it was also like you could see that that's the same person in there. Like the,
Interesting, you know,
similar concerns still like, you know, somebody like read fiction writer, or was it fiction or nonfiction? But it was like, you know, both were like driving around in a car with friends, you know, and in a way it felt like the same car ride. It just had continued like 18 years later or whatever. Yeah.
That would be so scary. Just the aggressive insecurity I had when I was 18 and then reading something now. And I'm like, oh, it's the same.
It was pretty funny. I found like a prose, fragment, and it was like, oh, this is the week I read James Joyce's The Dead. You know, it was like a total ripoff of like, oh, there's the weather and a funeral, and I forget what happens. I guess somebody's dead. That's
Well, I guess really quick though. So, did you when you wrote through? Were you an English major at Dartmouth? Like, you wrote through. I mean, because this book just came out. It came out this year, right? Huge Cloudy.
Yeah.
So, I mean, there was a long gestation period, kind of, to it.
Sure. Yeah. I was a creative writing major in undergrad. So eventually,
Okay. So
yeah. I let's see. What? So I I remember there was actually a road trip I took. You had to apply to take creative writing classes.
Oh, I thought you said you had to yeah. apply to take a road trip.
Yeah.
In Dartmouth.
Very structured. But you had to apply, and I'd applied a couple times and not gotten into the intro class of, you know, whatever, creative writing 80. And
But Dartmouth's a good school, too.
Yeah, there are a lot of good writers. And there are, like, people who had very clearly, like, taken, you know, been in literary journals in high school.
Oh, really?
Or, like, who are, like, much more,
losers.
Like, much more put together in terms of, like, this is what poetry is. Like, I'd read almost, I remember, like, actually finding a, it must have been read early in college, late in high school, like, a Galway Canal book. Oh. At a used bookstore, and I saw, like, oh, these are poems about New Hampshire, and it, like, hadn't occurred to me to, like, write about where I was from, right? Like, and people say that all the time, right? You have to see yourself represented in what you read to, like, feel like you can write yourself in a lot of ways. So, anyway, I had done some reading of poems, but not very specifically. I just didn't know what to write about, I think, is part of the problem.
And then I didn't know what to write about.
Yeah, and then, like, I took this road trip. I took, like, the part of the spring off and, like, flew to New Mexico, met a couple friends, and we drove, like, all around the West and then, like, you know, Utah, New Mexico.
Which year of school was this?
This was my sophomore year.
Okay.
Drove all around the West, and that's when I remember writing, like, we were staying at somebody's house in Jackson, Wyoming, and that's when I kind of wrote about the West, and then those were definitely, like, Gary Snyder ripoff, beat poetry ripoff poems, mm-hmm. but I think there was, like, a little bit more grit and things, like, things of the world in those poems,
mm-hmm.
So then I took that summer, I took, like, a creative writing class. Then the following fall, I went to Glasgow to study abroad.
Oh,
and that was great because it was, like, a group of English majors, and we didn't really have much to do in terms of school, it turned out, because the finals were after we were coming back. So we just had to write one paper. We didn't have to take exams, which was great. Oh. So we just spent a lot of time, like, bullshitting in coffee shops and
You didn't get intoxicated regularly?
Oh yeah, no, I that did too. We had a schedule, like, where's the pound pints, you know,
right,
like, Tuesday night here, Wednesday night here. Yeah,
say,
we did.
Yeah,
it was like coffee shops all day, bars all night. And then it was open mic nights we would go to. I remember.
Did you play music?
I did not, no. Oh. I play the guitar recreationally only.
But did you play at those open mics?
No.
Oh, you did?
No, but I had a friend who's good singer, songwriter, and he did. I forget. Yeah, that's why we were going. So we were kind of supporting him, and it was just fun. It was the first time I'd lived in the city, too, really.
Well,
so
yeah,
was,
why'd you choose Glasgow out of all?
Well, the English department had three kind of, like, exchange programs where they'd send a professor, and there was one in Dublin, one in Glasgow, and one in Trinidad, and they just kind of assigned you, I think. You know, you applied, and then they'd be like, you're offered a spot in Glasgow. And so the professor who's the Dartmouth professor who's going with us was Cleopatra Mathis, and she actually had the Provincetown Fellowship with Dennis Johnson, I think.
Oh, really?
Yeah, back then. But so she was a poet, and then when I came
Cleopatra
back.
Cleopatra Mathis.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
I don't know her work, unfortunately.
Yeah, she's got a lot of books out there. She's lived in New Hampshire for a long time, but is originally from Louisiana.
Okay.
But yeah, so then I came back from that and started taking, I took like the poetry that winter.
You got in.
I remember I took that was like my favorite quarter of classes ever. It was like poetry, Bob Dylan, and the Civil War, which was like a long-term obsession.
Yeah.
But so it was like and then I took creative writing classes. I think part of it was being in that small class, like the 12 to 15 people, rather than like a bigger English class appealed to me. So
sure.
Yeah.
But you did an MFA too, or
in UNC Wilmington.
Did you take a time off between Dartmouth and UNC Wilmington, or?
I took a year off.
Oh, so not that, okay.
Yeah, I was a ski instructor in Colorado.
Well, but I mean, so you, but you have you ever kind of, I guess, questioned, because this is, you've kind of been writing poems or just writing generally. Have you ever questioned some of this stuff over the years?
Writing?
Well, I've invested a lot of my time and energy and kind of my sense of self in stuff. Right. And then, you know, you get rejected or you even, you sometimes you don't feel value even if you get something accepted or you write something good. I mean, I guess I'm wondering, as you've grown older, has that kind of dedication ever shifted? Have you ever taken a year off writing? Have you ever been like, I don't know?
I've like abandoned many poems, right? Like, so that's been part of it for me, is just kind of leaving. Like, you know, I certainly don't do anything with my undergrad poems, but I remember graduating and like from my MFA and
When did you graduate from MFA?
2007.
Okay, so a little bit ago. Yeah,
a while ago. Yeah, and I remember one of my advisors saying, "Oh, this is such a good book," and I was like, "It's not a book." Like, I had no intention, because I already knew that I wasn't. I like the next poem I'm gonna write, right? So I knew at that, I was like, "Nah, I can do better than those poems," and they weren't. You know, there's something about them that I felt like wasn't what I wanted my poetry to be. So there's like that period. And then after that, I moved to Seattle, and I would say I took not time off, but I did definitely, when I first moved to Seattle, was spending more time, going to see shows, playing the guitar. I learned to play the guitar in grad school, as one does. And I would say,
as one does,
I would say like it was in Wilmington. We were there for 3 years. So there was like a little bit of time to spread out. And, I know a lot of the people there were really into music, and were in bands and played music and stuff like that. It felt like everybody who was in the program wanted to be a musician in a lot of ways. Right. Like, you know, David Berman was kind of like felt like a patron saint in a way, mm-hmm. both his poems and his music. So, when I moved to Seattle, I didn't really write much for the first couple of years I was in Seattle. And then it was more like in 2010, getting a fellowship through an organization, Jack Straw, in Seattle, mm-hmm. that like, then I was doing readings in town. You had to do like 5 readings for that fellowship. So that was like, kind of got me out there. I got to meet more poets, but I was always writing sometimes.
Yeah. What brought you to Seattle?
It was, I think, just like choosing a city.
Okay.
That was, and then there were like specific circumstances, but yeah, I knew I wanted to live in a city. New York seemed too unwieldy. Boston was too New Englandy.
But it could have been any city. It could have been New York. I mean, really just, all right.
Well, and then like applied for jobs in Portland, but there, I remember looking, I think it was also like feeling like I wanted to be closer to like mountains and stuff like that, mm-hmm. on some level. So, I remember applying, like in Portland, there weren't really jobs to apply to. In Seattle, I didn't get a job, but I could apply to jobs. So that felt like more doable. And then my wife's parents retired to Whidbey Island. They hadn't moved into their house yet that they bought there. They were in New Jersey. So there's like a house kind of near Seattle, like a couple hours that we could go to for a summer and like take stock of the
situation.
So
you were already married at that point?
Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, no, we weren't married.
Okay.
But you were together.
Okay. Yeah. We got married in 2009.
Okay.
I should know.
Kind of right after.
Yeah.
All right. We're going to play a song by Palace Music. Guitar.
There's a black tinted sunset with the prettiest of skies. Lay back, rest your head on my thighs. There is some awful action that just breathes from my hand, just breaths from a deed so exquisitely grand. And you're always on my mind, and you're always on my mind.
You put Bob Dylan on your list, but it'd be too perfect if we played a Bob Dylan song when you were talking about Bob Dylan. But this is guitar based. Why Will Oldham?
Yeah.
Did you ever try? Do you know songs by him?
Do I know, like, to play?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah. It kind of fits in biographically to what we've been discussing.
Perfect.
I remember being in Glasgow and a friend who knew I liked Bob Dylan and other stuff. I can't remember what else, but he was like, "Do you know Bonnie Prince Billy?" And I was like, "That sounds strange. What's that?" Yeah. "What's that?" And I actually remember going, you know, I had to order it at the record store in Glasgow, and got like this album, Ease Down the Road, which that's not on. That's an earlier song, but I just remember walking through Glasgow listening to Ease Down the Road like all the time, like just on repeat in my Discman, walking through the park, walking through the streets. And then I remember, so I became a big fan of Wildham's work, and then
What'd you grasp onto early on?
In that album, which was, the first album that I heard and liked, I think there's a strangeness to it, right? Mm-hmm. There's like it feels like a place, but it's like a place. I mean, there's that, I'm going to bring Bob Dylan into it, but
Bob Dylan. I like Bob Dylan.
Real Marcus has that book about Bob Dylan's basement tapes, mm-hmm. The Old Weird America. And there's something Old Weird America about.
Sure. He's a weirdo. Will Oldham's a weirdo. Yeah.
So there's something that I think that I grab, you know, there's like a sense of storytelling and characters, but then it's all like slightly off, and unexpected and in different ways. So I think I was drawn to that, the storytelling and stuff like that. And I think the lyrics are, good.
Well, yeah, do you listen to lyrics? I mean, Bob Dylan when you're younger, I mean, but do you now or even 5-10 years ago? I mean, do you listen to lyrics consciously or unconsciously as kind of things to use in your own work? I don't mean like plagiarize, but I mean, you said the narratives of a song. I mean, I don't always listen to lyrics.
Yeah, I think I'm very capable of tuning out lyrics when I listen to music now, but I do think that there are artists like Frank Ocean, who mm-hmm. I think I sent you, but like there's Frank Ocean's lyrics are so like specific, and I would say especially on Blonde, like so specific to his experience, and that I don't know, there's something about that like that specificity. Here's a person moving through the world, thinking about the world, and maybe it's something, a strangeness that appeals to me in people's lyrics. Because if it's not strange or like not specific and interesting, I think I just kind of, I can like it, but I won't pay as much attention.
You don't maybe attach a personality to it
in
the same way.
Yeah, and it feels like, I'm trying to think like somebody, I don't know, like The National, that has like, I think, lyrics that are specific and strange too, but they don't feel as personal often. So I kind of tune them out. There are lines that get stuck in my head.
Right. Well, you sent us Nikes by Frank Ocean, so let's just listen to the start of that.
Need it.
So what about, I mean, we didn't listen to the whole song, but we'll put it on the playlist. What about that song in particular?
Well, I don't know if it's that song so much as the album Blonde as a whole, but I do like, so in that song, it's occurring to me that like in the, you know, there's something maybe melancholic and a little minor chordy about some of my choices, which I think also is like something I like in
you
my music.
You are a poet.
Yeah, exactly.
Poets are melancholy.
To be expected. Yeah. So I just remember hearing that album, and there was like, I don't know if you remember, just like, was it years of like, when's Frank Ocean's new album gonna drop? And it was like, he had that thing, like in some sort of post with like the library due dates keep changing and crossed out. Like it's coming. But then, you know, he kept teasing this album or kept getting delayed or whatever. And then there was something about starting an album that people have been waiting for so long in like this pitched, altered version of your voice.
Right.
That I was like, what is this? And I was like, did I download the wrong?
Well, that's what I don't know Frank Ocean that well. So yeah.
So eventually his, you know, there's a pause and a break, and then his actual voice comes in. But yeah, I think, and I hated that the first time I heard it. I was like, no, I do not want this. Like, I like this song, but why? Mm-hmm. I don't know. But then now I like it. And I think he does it on other tracks too. And I've heard him, I've read that it's to represent youth in a way or something like that. It's like, because it's kind of his story. I don't know. The poems are kind of nostalgic, melancholy looks at youth. And so it's like, it was just interesting to me that I could have this kind of disappointment upon first listening to it and then like being totally won over by it.
An appreciation.
Yeah.
I actually just heard this album for the first time a month ago and was like, what? It really? This is amazing.
Yeah.
And it was really incredible. When I heard that it's the opening track on the album, right? You know, it's that, that it really reminded me of Prince. It's Camille, his alter ego, you know, is just a pitch shift version of his voice. And, but you know, that one is like a female alter ego. So I was kind of thinking, I was like, but this is different. He's doing something different, but it feels like in homage to Prince in this way. But it's interesting. I didn't know that the character was like a youthful side.
I don't know. Like, that was like on a podcast I heard.
Okay.
like that.
Did he say that though? Or did somebody else?
I think somebody was, he said something like that to about a different song. So I think there's another song that's pitched up, and it's, he said that to like a New York Times reporter in an interview when it came out. But yeah, I think there's something.
But it goes to expectation again.
Yeah.
You expect one thing, and when you get something else, sometimes initially you're turned off, but then that can later on, if you kind of stay invested in it, it's the reason why you like it.
Yeah,
I mean, like Earl Sweatshirt, his first album Doris, like it starts off without him rapping. It's another rapper who I don't like as much as Earl Sweatshirt. But now I like the way that it starts because there's something kind of humble, I guess, a little bit about it too. Always in the context of that, but it also it doesn't really allow you that immediacy that sometimes we really really want, especially after waiting so long. I mean, it throws you, but then it can also that can be the hook, you know.
Yeah.
Because sometimes the more we're shunned, especially after years and years, the more invested we are, especially if we don't get that immediacy that we're expecting.
Yeah, and like this album compared to Channel Orange, the one before it, which just had, you know, these like was much poppier, I would say, like had hits. It felt like more like this is an album of hits. And then this one is much more of a piece, I would say.
Right.
You know, it's like, and then to see, I know, just, and now it, I saw it was like a Pitchfork's top album of the decade. So it's I think so.
Really?
Yeah, so it's like become appreciated. But well, I do think there is like.
And that's like Kid A and Radiohead. I mean, like people really liked OK Computer, which had a lot of hits. And then, I mean, I'm old, but like Kid A was like, oh, this is not like, you know, it's the same type of thing. And now I'm sure that was Pitchfork's best decade. I don't know, but
I'm sure it was, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. But again, it goes to expectation. We expect, and I don't know Frank Ocean that well, but you expect another one like his first one that had hits. And when you don't get it, there's initially, this isn't my thing. But then it's better off for not being a version of what the first one was.
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting. I don't know if people read poetry the same. I guess they might. I don't know.
But going in with expectations of what the writer is going to do.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know. I think what do you think? You don't think that? I guess it depends on the reader. Are you talking about culture at large or just certain readers?
Yeah, I think I'm just thinking about myself, I guess. Like, what do I expect when I am reading a book of poems by
someone? I think for me that's the hardest thing to get past. Like, I went and saw a documentary about Audre Lorde, 2 weeks ago. And then I had not read much of her work, so I got it collected and like a single collection. And I like them both, but I kind of wish I hadn't seen the documentary first, because now I expect certain things unfairly from these books of poems. And I guess they're giving me that, but they're also, they're both doing too much and not enough because of my own expectations. I mean, was Huge Claudy was a contest finalist at a bunch of different places, right?
Yeah.
And I'm sure, did you change up the form? I mean, because how did that work in terms of your own expectations versus what publishers wanted?
Because
you're coming close and then you're not getting it, you know? I mean, were you like, I just need to keep setting this out? Or did you switch it up? I mean, it's a hard sieg, but I guess I'm curious.
Yeah, I was very much, I think it was a finalist like over a period of like 5 years or something. And in some ways, that was like a curse because it was like, all right, I'm just, rather than like, I need to work on this book. I was like,
you're
it out.
So close. Yeah, and it was at good places too. Yeah.
So there was that aspect. But I also, even when that was happening, I was always changing it. You know, I was always switching stuff out. So it was kind of changing like 20 pages at a time. It would shift.
So a lot.
Even after it was accepted by Octopus, it was it was about 2 years before it was published, I think. And so I changed it quite a bit.
But then you had the luxury of knowing this is coming out, so you could. It's harder when, like, this is a finalist at a contest.
Yeah.
I came very close. Should I just send it? But you felt confident that I'm going to switch this up because I believe.
Yeah, it took a long time before. I always knew it wasn't. There was something that about the shape of it that I was having a hard time feeling settled. And in retrospect, it's five sections now, and I think I like added a section, and then it started to make more sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
Like it started to feel more like, okay, this is the movement of the book. It always felt a little unbalanced, no matter how, like there was one section of like short poems, connected short poems, and then three sections of just poems. And then no matter how I shifted things around there, put new poems in, took poems out, it was like it never felt quite right. And then it was adding the second section is the newest section, Aurora, and that was a lot of short poems. And so then it was like the second and the fourth sections were like short poems. I don't know. There's something OCD had to be symmetrical or something. Yeah, there's a balance. And then I started to feel like, okay, this is, things are settling in. Now I can like do something with those, like the first, middle, and last sections started to feel, I was like, I can kind of shape those in a way. Having that balance enabled me to properly order the other poems, I think.
Interesting. I was thinking about that while reading it. And aside from the balance, were there particular ideas you had of each section? Do you have like a...
They're very, they're so vague as to be useless, I think, to a reader.
There's
something about like the last section is more explicitly about family, I think, or like it felt, I was trying to like return in some ways. So I was kind of like return, what's a journey coming to an end? The middle section is more like out into the world. and there's more like, I thought of it as the political section. It's like not specific platform that I would run on, but it's there's something political in some of those poems. And then in the first section, it was like poems the first was easy. I was like, this is how it begins. I don't know if there's a theme so much, but there are some pretty late revisions to the book in terms of like, there's one poem, Troublesome Pilot, that I kept writing and writing and revising and couldn't get it right. And then I kind of blew it open and made it like 6 pages instead of 2 pages or 3 pages. And that, like, suddenly the first section felt more complete with that longer poem within it. So there's, yeah, there's something, but that was, I think, a few months before the book was published that I did that.
Interesting. Just a few months.
Yeah. Wow.
And I guess, I mean, we want you to read a couple from it, if you don't mind, but it'd be cool if you're like, actually, I do mind. I've been talking about this a little bit, but it's a private thing between me and my book. And does it, I mean, one of the things, because Josh, you wouldn't really say you're a poet, right?
No, I used to identify as that in my, you know,
right,
late teens and early 20s. And
but not as much.
No, not so much now.
Yeah. I mean, does it matter so much if people read it from front to back? I mean, a lot of people, like, because you're talking about themes and how it didn't feel right. I mean, because a lot of people don't read, and it's something that I think about a lot. Well, people don't read poetry books the same way you read a novel, obviously. I mean, is it best for you? I mean, for you as the author, is it really important?
It's not important to me, no.
Okay, because some people...
Because I don't read. I have to really make myself, my instinct picking up a book of poems is like my thumb lands about 60% of the way through, and I kind of look there and then I'll look at the first poem, and I hop around a lot, and I have to like really consciously say like, I'm going to read this poem in the order it's written I don't like to do that necessarily.
Okay. But some poets are very, I mean, like this is where it begins and this is there for a reason and yeah.
And I think there's something too about like how I read now. Like I often when I'm reading or when I'm listening to music for that matter, it's like I listen to music for writing or mm-hmm. I read for writing. And so when I think when I'm reading in order to make myself write, I'm not a very good reader necessarily. Like I'm not totally paying attention. I'm like looking, it's like I'm paying attention to every fifth word that like, you know, something that like makes me want to write, like, mm-hmm. But it's not necessarily reading the poems on their own terms. I'm like thinking, how can I use what's going on here to get words down on the page?
Yeah, I know that, like, kind of a catalyst to the feeling of creative energy or something.
Almost like you're squinting at the poem to try to, like, you don't want to read it too closely.
right.
Like, I'll do that sometimes, just, like, kind of, like, squint at a poem I really like and say, like, okay, how can I use what this person's doing to do my own writing?
I like that.
In a way, though, that's problematic or not?
I think it's...
It works. Yeah, I think it's good. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, because, I mean, there are poems in here that are, I think, specific homages to other people, but then there are some where I know I was reading this poem, but I don't know that somebody
but
else
no
needs
one knows.
To,
that's the thing. And sometimes you think it's really obvious, then no one knows.
And there was the notes section at the end where you would say this is in reference to this.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there were some things where, you know, like I was like, oh, this is based on a Sebald book, you know?
Yeah, that one. And there's something for me where I don't like to have like the after. Mm. I like the poem on, you know, where she said like after Sebald.
Oh, right.
You know, like I like just reading the poem and then having the note if you care.
Well, and it gives, I mean, there's just interesting people here. Edmund Spencer, Shelley, there's Hopkins at some point, right? I mean, mm-hmm. it's, a lot you're not only reading from contemporary stuff.
Right.
Do you want to read a few?
Yeah, sure. Any requests?
Well, I think you get this one a lot. I like Kiko's Missing at the mm-hmm. start, and then I like 61, the there. I mean, I'll just say those two.
Okay.
Can I request the Better Luck Next Year one?
Yes.
All right.
Yeah, nice. Do I talk about them or just read?
You can do whatever you want. You're the artist. Okay. We're just the...
All right. So this is called Kiko is Missing. Kiko is missing, but her picture is everywhere, and her owner, my neighbor, paces the living room, talking to the carpet's tessellations, but not to Kiko, who is missing. My grandmother spoke to patterns, too, refused to look from the museum's marble tiles to its sculptures. She said, "My niece writes wonderful poems, but she had no niece and hardly had me in mind." She said, "I am no longer the person who once tried everything." Then she gave me my grandfather's axe. I replaced the head, and I replaced the handle. It is my axe now. So, like, that, like, there's a line in there, I'm no longer the person. I'm pretty sure I heard that in a podcast, and I tried to find it, but I couldn't find, like, who, it was, like, on Fresh Air or something.
Right.
Talking to an actress.
Why, is it in italics, though?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And then, so Better Luck Next Year. This was, I wrote this, this is an excerpt of the poem Bounding Sphere, and I took a workshop with a poet, Jeffrey Nutter, where you had to write all these, it was like writing 10 poems in 2 hours or something like that. And one of the prompts was to use a cliche in every line, like the same cliche. And I was like, well, that's never going to work. What a terrible idea. but then, you know, I kind of, with that starting point, wrote this from Bounding Sphere. Better luck next year, we said, gathering materials. Better luck next year, we whispered under tiles, eaves, under thatch edge and water pipe. Better luck sprouting where the gutter drips. Plum purple we were, lucking into New Year's. Better luck, we said to center cloud. Better luck to cloud edge. What could be better, we said, as a shadow met us on the sea beach. Better luck, I said. Next year, you said, and didn't elaborate. Better, 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 we said. We said, luck, 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 with zero perspective. Lucky clods, we said, having misspoke, looking skyward. And the there, there, this poem is one that I read, and my friend was like, it ends there. Oh. I was like, I had the same, that was when I had the same sense. And I, this was like, I was on the bus and heard this guy talking about going hiking in Iran to look at waterfalls.
Hmm.
And then kind of
stole
that from him. Stole his vacation.
stole his vacation.
The there, there. Rain plumps the country up, and the country was plenty plump enough. A big country with its big yellow mouth of an interstate warning, hard edge, until we felt the soft shoulder give way beneath our tires, jerk the wheel to the left toward some consolation forming in a far corner of the hangar. Air power. Maybe war would bring the far sea closer. Better we let oars do that. The ambassador said, this error will find another war to hide behind. Were those blue bells in the field? No. Helmets abandoned by the occupying forces. The ambassador said, the cities are violent, yes, but you'll be fine if it's raining. So we woke to see if water fell as the day began, as war began for the day before the day began for those who began the war. It was us. We heard it on the radio. That's how we knew.
All right.
Yeah.
Awesome. Huge Cloudy from Octopus Books. Bill Carty, any final words?
No, this was fun. Thanks for chatting.
Yeah, thanks for being here.
Be safe so you don't have to be sorry.
The Steer is recorded at KBOO Studios in Portland, Oregon. It's broadcast through Dublab Radio, KZUT in Los Angeles, and can be found anywhere you listen to podcasts. Thanks for joining us.